Good evening. Welcome to Council Connection for the month of July. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. It's summertime, and that means lots of parties, picnics, and outdoor activities. But it also means our national ACB conference and convention, which is taking place this year in Sparks, Nevada. As this show airs, the convention will be winding down, and we'll all be starting to pack and get ready for the long journey home. We'll be reporting on convention activities next month on Council Connection, but this month we'll be revisiting our own convention, which took place in the spring. Let's begin by talking about an exciting breakthrough in technology, a new Braille display from Orbit Research. Here's Venkatesh Chari to tell us more about it and to give us a little background on the company.
The way we describe our vision is disruptive innovation, limitless possibilities. We're a very small company, you know, founded in 1998 with a singular mission of developing high-performance but affordable products for the blind and visually impaired community. My own background is in electrical engineering, and we're essentially a team of engineers who consider ourselves extremely fortunate for being able to do what we love, inventing and developing new technologies and products that make a difference in people's lives is truly a dream job for us. And nothing really excites us more than embarking on the next challenge, and there are many in our field, ranging from indoor navigation to graphic displays. We like to believe that nothing is impossible. Our first product was a talking scientific calculator, a mainstream Texas Instruments TI-34 calculator, which we adapted to provide speech output. This product, the Orion TI-34, provided a lot more functions than talking scientific calculators that were available at that time, and was priced at a third of their cost, and more importantly, was identical in functionality to the calculator used by sighted students in the inclusive classroom, and therefore required no special training for the math teacher or the parents. While the Orion TI-34 and its successors were very well received, the high school students needed to use graphing calculators. So we then developed the world's first accessible handheld graphing calculator by adapting a Texas Instruments TI-84 calculator. This was a major breakthrough in STEM education, as the TI-84 Plus calculator is an integral part of the high school curriculum, and for the first time, blind and visually impaired students could use the same device as their sighted peers. And last year, we introduced the Orion TI-30XS multi-view scientific calculator, which is the world's first multi-line scientific calculator, again, following the mainstream flagship products from Texas Instruments, which are part of the school curriculum. The among other products that we have developed is the iBill, which I think many of you are familiar with, and it is now available to all U.S. residents at no cost through the U.S. Department of Treasury's Currency Reader Program. We have also developed and provided a similar product for Canadian currency to the Bank of Canada. Our latest product is the Orbit Reader 20, which we believe is the world's most affordable, refreshable Braille display. It is a unique 3-in-1 device that serves as a self-contained book reader, a note taker, and as a Braille display that can be connected to a computer or a smartphone. The Orbit Reader is equipped with a 20-cell 8-dot display and is based on revolutionary Braille cell technology developed by Orbit Research. The breakthrough technology uses mainstream components and manufacturing processes to enable unique signage quality refreshable Braille at a fraction of the cost of the piezoelectric technology that has been used in Braille cells thus far. So we began developing this technology several years ago and created several prototypes demonstrating its viability. The technology was applied to create the Orbit Reader 20 with funding from the Transforming Braille Group, which is a consortium of blindness organizations from around the world. The Transforming Braille Group was formed in 2011 under the leadership of Kevin Carey, chairman of the Royal National Institute of Blind People, with the express purpose of increasing Braille literacy worldwide by enabling a low-cost Braille display. The Transforming Braille Group evaluated over 60 different technologies from companies around the world before selecting Orbit Research to develop this low-cost, refreshable Braille display. The Orbit Reader has been developed in very close collaboration with the members of the Transforming Braille group, as well as others, other friends in the blind community, including folks from the ECB. The design, therefore, brings to bear the collective experience and expertise in the use of Braille devices. Several iterations of prototypes and extensive field trials have allowed us to fine-tune its physical design, the ergonomics, and the software to provide a compelling user experience. The device is very compact and measures a little over an inch in height and is about 6 inches wide and 4 inches deep. It weighs under a pound and includes a Perkins-style keyboard with 8 keys and a space bar. It also has a cursor pad with left, right, up, down arrow keys and a select button for navigating through menus and files. Rocker keys are provided on each side of the line of Braille cells to control panning. Almost every aspect of the design of this went through several iterations as we got feedback and tried to improve the design to meet the expectations of the users. The keys, for instance, went through three completely different types of technologies, starting first with what is known as a rubber membrane keypad, then which is widely used but which doesn't give that great a tactile feel, and then switching to what are known as key switches from a company named Cherry, and some of you might be familiar with Cherry key switches. They are the best in the industry, are used in high-end keyboards. Give it great feel, but had a little bit too much travel, and were a little bit noisy, and made the unit a little bit bigger, so people still weren't thoroughly happy with those. And finally, we ended up designing what are known as scissors-type keys, which are the kind of keys that you find often in laptops, laptop keyboards. And these have very nice tactile feedback and are very compact, very low in height, and have very, 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 very low travel, and are also very quiet. So a lot of feedback and effort has gone into various aspects of this. The unit has a recess in the back, which contains an SD card slot, a micro USB socket, and a power button. The micro USB socket also serves to charge the unit, as well as to connect to a computer or a tablet. And the SD card slot, of course, is to load content, BRF files, text files, essentially any type of file. The unit is powered with a user-replaceable, fast-charging lithium-ion battery, which can be charged through the USB port. So in general, Braille devices can be categorized into Braille terminals, note-takers, and personal digital assistants, or tablets, as we call them now. Braille terminals are very simple devices which are intended to work only when connected to a host computing device, such as a PC or a smartphone, and may or may not include a Braille keyboard. Note takers additionally include a file editor and perhaps functions such as a calendar or a calculator and can be used in a standalone mode. Braille tablets are more sophisticated and run modern operating systems such as Android or Windows natively and provide the ability to run third-party applications and connect directly to the internet. The Orbit Reader 20 falls into the note-taker category and is intended to be an affordable Braille device offering the three key functions that are required by most users. It can be used as a standalone book reader and enables the user to read any file from the SD card. These can be BRL or BRF formatted books, text files, or essentially files in any format that can be opened as a text file. It will actually read any format, but won't be able to appropriately display it because it doesn't really include any translation functions. So this book reading capability allows students, especially in developing countries, to have content loaded onto the SD card by their teacher and use the unit without any live connectivity to a computer or to the internet. The reader has various features for easy navigation, inserting and editing bookmarks, browsing through folders, etc. As a Braille display, the Orbit Reader acts as a terminal and connects to PCs and Macs, iOS devices, and Android devices. It provides Bluetooth and USB connectivity and can connect simultaneously to multiple devices. The screen reading capability on the computing device can then be used to access and control the functions of your computer or smartphone, use your favorite apps, read and send text messages or email, and browse the internet. The unit is compatible with most popular screen readers, including NVDA, JAWS, Windows Eyes, VoiceOver, and BrailleBack. Very recently, at CSUN, Amazon announced and showed the Orbit Reader 20 working with VoiceView, which is Amazon's screen reader for their Fire and Kindle tablets. The as a note taker, the Orbit Reader offers all essential file creation and editing functions. A user can create new files, save them on SD card, and edit existing files. It also includes file management features, allowing the user to rename, delete, copy, and create files and folders. And it is inherently language independent, and the unit allows very easy localization for different geographies, different languages. The localization is essentially as simple as translating a file that contains the different messages that appear on the display, such as low battery, you know, SD card full, and various menu choices, translating it into the language of your choice in a BRL file, and another file that contains the Braille translation table, which basically describes, you know, what characters translate to what patterns of dots. And those files can be created by anybody. We, of course, we'll provide them on our website as and when, as they're developed. And the idea is to have the community contribute their own files, which we'll make available through our website, and which can then be downloaded and used by any user of the device. The unit is designed to be extremely easy to use and allows seamless and instantaneous switching between reader, note taker, and Braille display modes, as well as selection between different connected devices, such as a computer or phone. It is also designed to be fluid and dust resistant, and its construction is optimized for durability in extreme environmental conditions, such as those that we expect in countries in Africa and Asia. So the focus in the definition of the Orbit Reader 20 has been to provide affordable, high-quality, refreshable Braille in a simple-to-use device. It is not intended to be everything for every user and makes trade-offs such as not having cursor routing keys, which would have made the unit more expensive. The primary goal of this model is to be an entry-level device that can be affordable for students in developing countries, and at the same time providing functionality and quality that are appealing to users in developed countries. There are various such trade-offs that we made, including what some of you folks might have heard, you know, speed of refresh. We can actually make the display refresh instantaneously, all cells at the same time, as you've come to expect from the piezo Braille displays. But we chose to, for cost purposes, refresh the cells from left to right. The refresh rate is extremely fast. It's better than a second. And for all but the fastest Braille readers, it's been found to be more than adequate. But again, these are some of the trade-offs that we made in designing the product so that it would meet the targets of affordability and feature set. So I'm really delighted to be able to say that the Orbit Reader 20 has now begun to ship. Thank you. As we ramp up production, the output is slow but steadily building up. And member organizations of the TBG, the Transforming Braille Group, are building up inventories before they start sending them out to end users. The product is distributed through the member organizations of the Transforming Braille Group and also directly from Orbit Research. And we are setting up distribution arrangements in other countries as well, outside the U.S. The wholesale price to the TBG member organizations is $320. And we expect that most organizations will sell it at a price point to the end user of less than $500. And in fact, it opens up the very tantalizing prospect of a complete connected reading as well as computing solution when coupled with devices such as the Amazon Kindle and Amazon Fire, both of which can be had for less than $50. So at a MSRP of $449, coupled with a $50 tablet, you have a complete solution for computing and reading and internet access. Sure. So I just want to close by saying that, you know, we're very excited about the core technology that has enabled this product, and we feel that this project is truly a landmark in demonstrating that when organizations and companies come together with a common goal and with a high degree of motivation, amazing things can happen. Thank you.
You're listening to Council Connection on the Talking Information Center Network. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit www.acbofma.org and look for the Council Connection. No matter how long you've been visually impaired, coping with a loss of sight is an ongoing and sometimes very daunting process. The ways we cope vary from day to day and are different for each of us. Jim Badger and Sharon Strzokowski led a panel on this subject as part of our Sunday morning session at our spring convention, and here they are to share their stories.
Recently, I annually take a trip to the Virgin Islands as my way of coping with the winter. On the way home, I'm in Logan Airport. I go to the restroom. I walk in there, and it's like this maze. And I have a little bit of vision, so I try not to have to carry my cane in the restroom because it always, as you all know, adds a whole other thing when you only have one hand. So I'm walking through there, and I do whatever I got to do, and then I come around, and I'm walking out. I'm looking for the door to get out. And I see it, and I make a beeline for it, and this guy comes flying at me. So I dodge to the right, and he goes the same exact way as me. So I dodge to the left, and he goes to the same exact way as me. And then I think, this guy's wearing the same coat I am. And he's got a beard just like me. Now, I think the people in the place probably would not have noticed it if I hadn't said, excuse me, to the guy who was me.
That's called Abba Pita.
Now, those are the things people don't realize. It's not people may think about the hazards and the dangers and the frustrations and the whatever. It's the weird things that people don't think about. I kind of got into thinking about this. As many of you know, I'm a rehab teacher at the Mass Commission for the Blind, and Sharon is a vocational rehab counselor there. And so we see people in all different stages of adjustment to blindness, and as Tony so aptly put it yesterday, too many times in rehabilitation people are kind of given a cane and said good luck, as if that's all there is to it. And as we all know, it is not all there is to it. I got interested in this because my background was in mental health before I became a rehab teacher, and because at the age of 49, of having been legally blind my whole life, I was walking around without a cane trying to pass and fell into the tracks at Back Bay. I was in the news. That was my 15 minutes of fame, folks. And so I had to ask myself, how can that be? I'm 49 years old, and I still have not come to terms with this. And so that set me on an odyssey. And when I went to work at the Commission for the Blind, there was a lot of discussion there about that a lot of people are going through a lot, and there's not a lot of services for people in terms of their adjustment, in terms of dealing with all the things you have to deal with when you have vision loss, even if it's since birth. And so I have to say, I got a tremendous amount of encouragement from everyone, from my supervisor right up to Paul Sehner, to do some work on this. And so I developed a training about adjustment to blindness and to life with blindness for beginning for the VR staff at MCB, but I'm sort of taking it on the road. I got a lot of invitations now to go places and talk about this, because we are whole human beings. We're not just blind people. And each of us has a lot to deal with. And what I'm not going to obviously go through my whole training today, because it's 2.5 hours. You're welcome. Maybe I'll put it on VoiceStream and play it really, really fast. But I do want to say a couple of things, and then we want to just say something personally, and then I'd like to throw it open to everyone, because we don't often get a chance as people with vision impairments and blindness in one room together to talk about this among ourselves, because we are a tiny minority in a large community, and each of us is often a tinier minority, even within our own families. And that's hard. So the couple of things I wanted to say. One is that I think if you think about adjustment to blindness, it's not really adjustment to blindness. It's really adjustment to the normal challenges of life that everybody has to deal with, but in the context of blindness. Because it's not like there are all these days and days and days that you're not adjusted, and then all of a sudden you're adjusted. It's that you walk into the men's room and some guy comes flying at you and he's in the mirror. You know, and that's an easy one. That's a really easy one. Falling in the tracks at Back Bay and losing your spleen is not. So there are a lot of different levels to this. And sometimes we are told it's just grieving, like any other grieving. And yeah, there's a level at which, yes, you go through all different stages of grieving. You go back and forth through the stages like any other level of grieving. But it's different. My mother passed away in 2010, and I feel sad about that. I still feel sad about that, particularly on anniversaries of things. But the day my mother passed away, it didn't interfere with my ability to take the bus or pour my coffee or find my clothes or figure out how to get out of the restaurant in the Marriott Hotel. It's a different kind of thing, because what we're dealing with is day by day. It's hour by hour, minute by minute. And most of the time it's fine, but when it isn't, it really isn't. And sometimes it gets really old. And it's hard to talk about that sometimes among ourselves, and certainly among, I think, a lot of people who are sighted, because it's hard to talk about it without sounding like you're whining or asking people to, or at least being treated like you're whining, and asking people to fix it. And at the same time, we can fall into either the trap of being too adaptable and pretending everything's okay when it isn't, or sometimes maybe being too angry right off the bat with somebody who's really trying their best but may just not know or maybe not understand. So I'm gonna turn this over to Sharon in a second. But I think for each of us, we can all think of times when the way we've dealt with something, somebody said to us, or maybe said to the person standing next to us, where we've done it well and it's worked for us, and we found a way to really keep our dignity when we're asking for help or when someone's offering help or forcing help upon us, and times we haven't done as well. And so we each wanted to talk a little bit about that. And there's a lot of wisdom in this room. It's not just us. So if you can think about either questions you have for other people here, something that's kind of sticking in your craw and you never figured out how to deal with, or suggestions you may have about what has worked well for you, how you do deal with these things day in and day out. I was hoping that we could share some of this wisdom together. Sharon?
Okay. I thought I'd give a ride experience that really taught me a lesson. Now, in Worcester, we don't have the horrible, horrible delays that can happen in Boston. But on a Friday night after my music lesson, I'm ready to go home. And I always seem to get the same van driver. And I'll say to him, "So are we picking somebody else up and then taking me home?" And he'll say, "Yep." and so I was feeling really frustrated with him. Like, I'd least like to know how long I'm going to be on here. Why aren't you communicating with me? And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, you know, I'm letting this have power over me. And the reality is I'm going to get home. I know I will. So I'm going to stop asking him this. And then one night we were riding together and there was a deluge, so much so that water was coming up over the van. It was really kind of scary. And during that time, we started to talk to each other as we had not before. And what I discovered was he didn't like to give information about, or we're going to pick up this one or that one, because he knew that I wanted to get home and that he couldn't fix the fact that I might not get home right away. So it was a real interesting lesson to me. So now when I'll get on, the last time I had him, I got on, he said, "We're picking up 10 people and then you're going home." and I laughed, you know. Now he still doesn't give me a lot of information, and I'm not really sure what triggered me being so uncomfortable, but I think I just felt like my dignity was on the edge there. And so my lesson from it was, first of all, to decide what really was important, and not to fret, and to try to understand his point of view, because he tries his best to get people where they have to go, but he has to go by the schedule. The other one I'd like to just say is sometimes at work, at lunch, there'll be a flurry of pictures from Facebook or whatever people are looking at, and I have given myself permission, and I've talked with the people there to say, sometimes I'm finished my lunch and I'm just going to go my way. Sometimes they try to describe a picture to me, and sometimes it just doesn't make sense to me. And so, when I was growing up, I would never have left a room of sight of people, who were watching a movie that I couldn't follow at all. Now I would. And I would go and say, "Well, you know, I think I'll read my book because I can't follow this James Bond movie," you know, or whatever it might be. So I think I have never been tested to the degree of people that wait for the ride for 3 hours. I think that would be a real affront to dignity in a way that I don't know how I would handle it. But I guess these little tests make you realize that even when you're a cog in a wheel and part of a system, you still have yourself. Thank you. Okay.
Just a quick ride thing.
that seems to
during be. during the 2000, was it 15? The big snowstorms.
Yeah.
Okay. I work at MCB, and so the T wasn't working well. And so they used to pick me up like at 6 o'clock. And they would come, and my day ends at 5. They'd come and pick me up at 7:30 or so. I said to my supervisor one day, "That's why they call it the ride. Instead of the rides, it's one long ride interspersed by your day." But at one point, I got on, and I'm going around to all these different places. And I said to the guy, "I feel like a UPS package." And the guy said, "Well, I don't think that's fair." And I said, "Well, no, it isn't. If I was a UPS package, I would have gotten there on time." I think it is I think one reason, other than the obvious inconvenience and endlessness of it all, one reason that this is a big topic for all of us is it is one of those situations where It's a great idea to have the ride. It's one of the ways, the only way we can get any place sometimes. And on the other hand, sometimes you can feel a lot less like a customer and a lot more like a UPS package. Mm-hmm. And how you keep your dignity in situations like that when it's when it's all feels sort of arrayed against you is really hard, and the dailiness of it makes it harder. So, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about adjustment, people talk about it as if it's our problem, like as if it's sort of like an internal mental health disturbance that we have to deal with. But there's a lot of reality to which we are adjusting, and pretty regularly. I wonder if other people had either thoughts or stories that they wanted to tell, or... here we go.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. All right.
I can go home now.
Okay. No, you can't.
Just want to give a little national perspective, and but it dovetails with the ride, too. I'm on the Fillmore phone system, and it goes all over the country, and there's all kinds of blind people on it. And I have a group that I run called ACB Friends. Now, you don't have to be an ACB member to be in it, but you we're not going to let anybody come in and trash ACB. And we have some NFB people who are very nice who are in it, you know, but that means that they at least have an open mind about ACB. And it doesn't mean we're trying to get members or anything. But one of the things we talk about in the group is blindness. We do it a lot. And so it's kind of funny when we say we don't do it that much because I hear it a lot on the group. But people are in rural Pennsylvania. They're in the middle of Texas. They're in all these places where they have no ride at all. And their dignity is really not there because their sister has to take them to the store. Uh-huh. The people from their church have to take them to, you know, where their doctor's appointments, whatever. What we have here is so much better, and we still have the best ride system. I mean, as much as we complain, we still do because we can do a lot of things that other people who do talk about their paratransit can't do. You know, it's not working on the weekends. But what we're fighting for, what Rick is fighting for in the committee, in the transportation committee, is to keep our dignity. Because if we don't have the ride and we don't have the T, now we do have the, I can walk to the T, you know, I'll still get from place to place. We have the option here in Massachusetts of being, and in the eastern part in particular, of being more independent than almost anybody else in the country. And we need to remember that, and we need to fight for that. And these other people would kill to have even half of what we have be able to get from point A. So our dignity issues that we do have, and they're very legitimate, compared to always having to kowtow to family members or friends who you can't even stand, but how are you going to get your groceries? Or figure out how are you going to pay them back? Do you have any money to give them? How are they going to not feel put upon? Oh, I got to go and take her to the grocery store again. We can get Peapod. We can go to the store. We can, you know, we can do all these things. We can get to work ourselves. We don't have to carpool with people who they can't stand us and we can't stand. We are very, very lucky, but we need to keep it that way. And that's what this is all about.
Thank you, Greg.
That's
Chris.
Right.
Excellent.
That's true.
Excellent. Someone else.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Rosemary Miller. Excuse me. And I just wanted to share a little story about being visually impaired or blind. When I first lost my eyesight in 1980, whatever, I did not have any training. And I can tell you that Cheryl Cummings came to me to do a little story. But the story was about me getting out there and using a white curtain rod to figure out how to get from place to place. And folks were looking at me on the bus like I had six heads with this white curtain rod and walking down the street. But the point of it is I didn't want to stay home. And I was like, look, I got to get busy because I was already working. I had been doing things and going to school and all of that. My story is kind of unique because I did not, and I'm sorry that, like, other people feel very angry and mad and upset about when they lost most of their eyesight. And my goal was to get back to work, get busy, keep it moving. And not everybody has that drive or that determination to do that when they first lose their eyesight. And I felt like it was important for me to go down to the Commission for the Blind, find the building, since I worked right next door to it. I had been there before And I watched people go in and out, and it was on Tremont Street at the time. So I watched people go in and out of there, and I was like, boy, that's really cool. But not really so much cool that they can get in and out of the building. It was just that there was this place that I could go to. And once I found out that I was able to do that, I went there and I tried to sign up to learn how to do Braille. And it was like, no, you're not blind. And I'm like, yes, I am. But they didn't say, you know, at the time, you had to be diagnosed by your optometrist and ophthalmologist and all this other stuff. And I was like, okay. Anyway, I go to Social Security with my white cane and rod, and I want to sign up for Social Security. And they're looking at me like I had six heads because I'm there with a white cane and rod. And very determined, very ambition driven to go places that I hadn't normally gone before. And I was, you know, feeling very confident that I could do this. And so to this day, I feel very confident that I can do some things, but technology is not one of them. So, but anyway, I just want folks to know that I am, you know, I feel that I've succeeded in something, but other people may not feel that way. And I'm, you know, I'm not apologizing for you, but I know that I'm very confident in my level of training that I've gotten from the Carroll Center and the training that I got from all support systems from the Commission for the Blind, the rehab teachers, and the counselors that come out and show me hundreds of times how to do something, and I really appreciate that.
Great.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose. I mean, that, you know, the fact that you were able to do that right away is amazing, 'cause, and there are a lot of people who can't right away, but who end up, I mean, a lot of the people I see who are very active in the blind community, who are out there speaking and advocating, will tell stories where, you know, for 2 years I sat in my pajamas in my house, I just couldn't do it. People do it at different speeds, and that's part of what I felt a real mission to get across, because rehabilitation is driven by a lot of funding stuff like we were talking about yesterday, and sometimes there's a kind of feeling that we're rushed, but there's a real importance that we stand with people where they are at the time. And if people need some help to get through that first piece where they don't want to leave the house, they need a lot of support from the rehabilitation agencies and from people like us.
I also think you need help and support from the family members too, because my family, I knew of people that were blind in my community when I was growing up, so I didn't feel stressed about it, because I could see this gentleman that lived in my community. He was blind, and this man would be dressed to the T and go through the, you know, have the little kids at the time cross him across the street. He would give us a dime. I mean, a dime was like big money then, you know. So seeing people that were visually impaired and that were doing things, for me, I realized I could still do this. It's not that big of a deal. Well, so for me, I had confidence in people that were around me.
A lot of people don't have that,
right,
you know, at home. And so it just adds.
Right.
But I think the human spirit is very resilient. Yeah. And this is one challenge, and then you'll have another one, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
So, in terms of dignity, this is how I see it. It doesn't matter what other people necessarily think, but if you feel like you're carrying yourself with dignity, then you are. I don't really care, to be honest, what people think about me. But if I feel like I'm doing the best I can, and I'm doing it, and I'm putting myself out there, then you are carrying yourself with dignity. So I don't know if I'm making sense. But
Yes, you are.
Absolutely.
But indeed.
My wife says, oh, you know, you made him upset. I'm like, I don't care. I'm never going to see him again. You know? But carry yourself. What I mean is, though, it's a matter how you feel about yourself and how you carry. And then eventually other people will come around and see how you are and how you carry yourself. So I think it's how you feel about yourself and how you carry, and we should not worry about, oh my God, what are people going to think if I carry a cane? Who cares what they think? You know, the cane makes yourself independent, And by being independent, you are more dignified.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, when I was a cane resister, which I was for years and years and years, I had to come to terms with, after my accident, number one, you know, if you asked me, do I believe that blind people are less dignified than other people, I would have told you no. But if my fear was they're going to treat me with less dignity, so I'm going to hide it, in a way, then I'm kind of agreeing with them.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
Because in the end, you can't hide from yourself. And I think Carl's really right. If I act like it's less dignified to be blind, then what am I saying?
There's somebody else, I think.
This is David.
David.
Sorry. Yeah, well, on the ride, of course, we can talk about that one forever because I spend pretty much forever on the ride. But, and I may be the person you were referring to who waited 3 hours, many weeks ago, because I did.
Yeah, but I've heard it more than once.
Oh, yeah, I know you have. Probably from me, too.
Yeah.
But on that day when I had to wait 3 hours, the only way I could sort of deal with it was to sort of remind myself of what Chris said. It's like, okay, I'm sitting at the Carroll Center. It's going to take me 3 weeks, 3 hours to get home. But, you know, without the ride, I wouldn't have that job to be able to go back and forth to the Carroll Center.
Yeah.
Period.
That's right.
I wouldn't have that. But the thing that probably bothered me the most about that, and that bothers me a lot sometimes on the ride, and this might have something to do with your feelings towards that sort of non-communicative driver there, is the loss of control.
Yes. Exactly right, David. Right.
Because, you know, normal standard sighted person gets in their car, drives from point A to point B, and doesn't even think about the fact that somebody might force them to detour, or when they have to detour because there's something, they'll get furious because they've lost 2 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
One thing that drove me crazy before the advent of a certain technology called the iPhone on the ride was just that business of getting in the car and not knowing where you were going not knowing where you were at any point and having to sort of, when you did want to know, reminding myself of how I was when I was a five-year-old. You know, are we there yet?
Yeah.
Are we there yet? And this is not the panacea response, but one thing that helped me enormously was when I got the iPhone, I got a GPS app, and there's a little thing in there. You pop on it, and it says, where am I? Yeah. And I myself could know where I was. And there are drivers who I'm happy to chat with and ask where I am, but there's sometimes when you don't even want to ask that person where you are, and I can just do it myself. And then sometimes I get a little sneaky because I'll magically tell them, you know, we're at 1200 Center Street. And how did you know that? And I said, well, you know, because I have this sense. I know that bump is about that far away from that bump. And other drivers, I'll just admit, oh, I have this app on my iPhone. You could have it too. But, you know, you can use these things against people too. And that's a very nice thing.
Thank you.
I just wanted to respond to that a little bit. One thing that I've used a little bit is, okay, if I'm going to be on the ride, I might as well try to enjoy the other people that are on here. And I've made some kind of ride friendships, especially because there's people that go to work and come home around the same time I do. And one day there were four of us on there, and we just had such a good time together, you know. I mean, we were all glad to get home, but I guess sort of treating it as not just a getting from A to B, but also as part of the journey, sort of.
Okay, so three really rapid things. One is, one of the things that we have to be careful about in our community is this concept that, well, look, they're so together, I must be broken in some fashion. Trust me, it doesn't matter how many times you've been at a podium speaking, you're never not nervous. The best I look for is to get the butterflies to fly in formation. All right? I'm going to have butterflies each and every time, but I just get through it. There's a lot of sighted people out there that think we blind people have a sixth sense.
Oh, yeah.
It's marvelous. Well, the only extra sense I have that makes me get through my day is a sense of humor. If you can't laugh at it, you know, it is going to start piling up in your spirit.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to laugh at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, and I'm going to pick on all the people in, you know, professionals who use this word independence as if it's the holy grail of blindness.
Yeah. That's right.
The answer is, I believe in an interdependent means of going through life. When I say, oh yeah, I was in India last month or something. Ooh, you traveled alone? Sure I did. But did that mean that I used my cane every inch of the way? Hell no. I hired the cab driver to get me to this airport. I tipped the guy to get me to security, you know, whatever. I make my way kind of being passed hand to hand to hand.
Yep, yep.
In the process. Now, I agree. There's times that makes you feel like a UPS package. But the fact of the matter is, I know the first name of everybody I touch during that process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. I say, hi, I'm Brian. What's your name?
Yep.
And I have a conversation with each
one
of them. When I first moved to Massachusetts, I was really worried about getting off at the bus at the Carroll Center. And so I always sat in the front seat. And that's how I learned about baseball. I figured I had to talk to that bus driver about something so he wouldn't forget to let me off where I needed to get off, right?
Very smart.
So I started paying real attention to the baseball stuff the night before, and we'd get on and we'd chit-chat about baseball. That worked really well until the day that we were chit-chatting so much he missed my stop because we were chit-chatting. But that day he was so upset with himself that he pulled the bus over about a mile past the Carroll Center, jumped out, came back again, said, come with me, Brian. Got out, went over. He had flagged down a policeman. And I arrived to work in the back of a black and white. So, you know, I believe
that's where those
very
rumors
much.
Came from.
That's right. That's where the rumors came from. I just really think that having a chance to laugh about life, realizing that we're interdependent, not independent.
Mm-hmm.
We all grew up in families, right? Did everybody have to do everything themselves in a family? Not on your life.
No.
You know, the thing about things like the ride is that we, as human beings, we tend, since Adam and Eve ate from the fruit, we tend to think of things as either one way or the other. It's terrible or it's perfect. And things are not that way. I mean, to be able to, and it's a hard balance to strike, to be able to say, I am so grateful that we have this service because otherwise we would be in the position of someone in Texas who is stuck with relatives driving them all over the place. And it could be better. And there are things that we can advocate for in terms of our being treated with dignity. And it isn't necessarily, whether it's MCP, whether it's the Carroll Center, whether it's the ride, whatever it is, there's always things that we can advocate for, and it's good to be true to ourselves about this is good for me and this is not so good for me. I just think having that balance it's a hard one to strike. It's a hard one.
And there may be a day when you say, I just can't go out of the house.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's not a work day where you have to go out of the house. So that's why when we have a storm and the governor says, you don't have to go out of the house. It's lovely. Yay.
Frank wanted to say
thank you very much. I mean, Brian kind of made my point a little bit that we have this horrible stigma with the word dependence. And, you know, we kind of separate it from dignity. I mean, dependence is not a lack of dignity. We depend on many things. I depend on the supermarket for my food. I depend on the electric company to put a little bit of juice in my house. There's no harm to anyone's dignity in being dependent. And I'll tell you a little story. This is when my mother was in intensive care, bringing the women's hospital. And, I mean, I knew that her days were limited, but I didn't know how limited it really was. So I was on the 51 bus, and I was headed to downtown to Park Drive. And my cell phone goes off, and it's the doctor. And a very nice doctor. She said, you need to get here right now. Your mother's going very, very fast. So I'm on a 51 bus, and it terminates at Cleveland Circle. And I knew that, you know, but if I got on, waited for the green line, took the D line, I wouldn't have made it in time.
Mm,
so got to Cleveland Circle, and everyone rushes off the bus to get their train. I'm the driver, and I know there's cabs in a circle there, but I don't know where they are. It would have taken me a long time to find a cab. And I, you know, this is, you know, the time in my life when I decided that, you know, there's no dignity. This is the turning point where I realized there's dignity in being dependent on someone. I asked the bus driver, I don't have time to explain to you, but this is, I really need to get into a cab right now. She took my hand, put me right in a cab. I made it down there, and I made it in time to see my mother pass.
Oh.
So, anyway.
I have a story about the ride about Kathy that I want to tell, similar to that.
Yeah. So I just want to say that, you know, yeah. I'm guilty as anybody else, and more so probably that, you know, there's nothing wrong with being independent. There's no shot to anyone's dignity. In fact, sometimes that's how we make our human relationships. So that's all I wanted
True.
To say.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. Very good. Somebody else, I think. Someone who hasn't spoken?
Mary.
Oh, it's Mary. Sorry.
Yeah,
okay.
I have the mic. Thank you. Yeah. A couple things. One, I have to allow myself to learn to get used to being taking someone's arm and being guided. I remember when I didn't need that. So when you realize you're at the point of needing to be guided, you know, it is a hard transition. I appreciate the assistance. I know I need it, but I still don't like it that I need it. So there is a sense of, you know, we talk about dignity. I don't feel less dignified, but I feel a little bit more vulnerable needing that assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just a quick story. I was at my doctor's office, and I was checking out at the at the desk with my cane, and just not, you know, just doing my thing, walking out of the office, and a younger gentleman was leaving the office as well, and he came up to me and he said, "Oh, you do really well," and I said, "Oh," and he, you know, talked about, you know, you're blind, and you know, you're independent, you're out and about, and he talked about his grandmother, who, you know, that maybe the typical or, you know, stereotypical elder who was not feeling so independent and was more isolated and at home. And, you know, so he was comparing what I was doing with what he had known from his grandmother. So there are certain expectations that people have of blindness out there. And Bob talked about this, a lower expectation. So when we're out and about just doing our thing, not doing anything extraordinary, just routine things, people are noticing and they're looking at us maybe in a different way because they're realizing, oh yeah, we're going about our life doing things in a fairly normal way when they didn't think we could. So there is a lower expectation out there of people on the part of people towards those of us who are blind and vision impaired.
Right. Thank you. Shirley, I think you had something, right?
As you know, I could tell several stories. It's David Morrison.
Okay.
But I'm just going to say one or two. The one that really comes to my mind at the moment, I was working in downtown Boston, and I had a orientation and mobility instructor who introduced me to the financial district. and she said, you know, when in doubt, just go with the traffic. Go with the rest of the people, and I was almost taken out by a cement mixer and kissed by a bus. And so I decided to wait for the light wherever that was or whenever it was. And there was a homeless person who sat next to or underneath the walk sign. Mm. And I, when I first realized, because I have some vision, I first realized he was there and he had a sign. I couldn't read the sign. And so, well, how am I going to deal with him? So I, every morning, because I was in the world of work at the time, full time, when I got to that stop to cross the street, I would say hello. And at some point, he would see me coming, and he would push the walk sign for me.
Okay, very one, right.
It was like, wow.
That made his day.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Hi, it's Jennifer. I'm really thankful you all are bringing this topic. I think we can get caught up in a lot of the practical how-tos of our phones or whatever. I wanted to throw out an idea of kind of something you might try that worked for me, the using public assistance. I, for a long, long time, just hated using public assistance, but I was having so many issues last year getting across streets on my work route that I was about to throw in the towel on my wish to be able to just walk to and from work every day. And I was taking mobility lessons, and that was really helping a lot. But I knew that using public assistance lesson was going to be coming up, and I refused to have to have that lesson. So I went 2 weeks going cold turkey. Any opportunity to use public assistance, I took advantage of. If there was someone on the corner, hey, can I get an elbow? Someone offered, yes, I'll take it, because usually I would say no. And it was hard to start with, but then it was so funny. Like, the people I would meet, we'd have this quick conversation. The one was a jogger who I asked for help crossing, but he had the sweatiest arm and smelled disgusting. He was embarrassed to be asked to help, as I was to have chosen him to ask. Then there was the guy who, you know, I can't see anything, so he asked, you know, can he offer me some help across? And I said, oh, may I take your elbow? And he paused and kind of hesitated, and then he said, yeah, sure. So we're halfway across the street, and something seemed weird, and I said, I'm sorry, something seems a little unusual. He said, well, yeah, I'm riding a bike.
So, oh, my goodness.
I'm telling these in a way because a lot of times negatives. That damn person, you know, said this or this. And there can be a lot of those. I don't want to minimize all the negative experiences. When I have those negative times, though, this is what sticks in my mind. That sweaty jogger, that guy on the bike, this nice woman. I told Sharon and Roz at breakfast this morning. You know, her name's Trish. I've met her every morning. We talk for 2 minutes on a windy day. She might give me a hand crossing a difficult street. Okay. But I know her now as my work friend. And now she retired, and now I don't get to see her in the morning anymore. So anyway, make notes of these people you meet, the journeys you have along the way. It's kind of like the Dr. Seuss, oh, the places you'll go. The people you'll meet, or the people you may never want to meet again. But it's fun, and there's some great people out there in the world.
Absolutely.
So.
Well, that'll just about do it for Council Connection as I jump on my bicycle and ride off into the sunset for the month of July. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please feel free to leave a message for us in the BSCB mailbox at 617-923-4519. I'm your host, Steve Dresser, and I hope you'll join us again in August when I'll be back with another edition of Council Connection and a full report on the ACB Conference and Convention in Sparks, Nevada. Enjoy the summer, and we'll see you again in August. Take care.